remember those innocent times when there were only 7 broadcast channels to choose from in New York and a lot fewer in many other areas? When Ralph Baruch was at Viacom, he was one of the early champions of cable television, and the work he did in the 70s and 80s laid the groundwork for much of the vast television industry we take for granted today. He's written a memoir called Television Tightrope, How I Escaped Hitler, Survived CBS, and Fathered Viacom. It's published by Probitas Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
What would our TV and cable service be like today had the Federal Communications Commission kept in place the tight regulations against cable service that used to be?
It'd be completely different. You wouldn't see too many services in cable. You'd see maybe one or two movie channels and a couple of other channels, but even those attractions were severely restricted by the commission. And that's why eventually the cable industry, and I headed that committee for several years, had to sue the FCC and the Supreme Court on First Amendment, threw those regulations out.
And then when you won, what did you think was going to happen? Suddenly the whole world changed.
Well, demographically, I think the cable would be divided, I felt, into a multitude of channels. And that's why we started to compete with HBO by starting Showtime. We did our first provision of service with cassettes because there were no satellites. And eventually the satellites, which really was the beginning of the downfall of the networks, when it began operating, that's when we started Showtime on a national service and competed with HBO to some extent.
Your life is rather improbable when you look at this. Your book begins when you were a child in Nazi Germany, and then your family escapes to Paris?
My dad was an international lawyer. He was quite a scholar. He spoke 9 languages, plus Latin and Greek, but he was a fervent anti-Nazi, and in 1933, we had to overnight run away from Germany, and he came from Alsace-Lorraine originally, so we went back to France. And then in 1938, after he offered and they declined, but they came back to him and asked him to help them, the French, with the Deuxième Bureau, which was counter-espionage, and he volunteered, no pay. Even when the war broke out in 1939, he still went to Germany to recruit spies because he had fought saber duels and looked German. And he came back to Paris on May 10th, 1940, when the Germans invaded Holland and Belgium, and didn't want to leave Paris.
Now, he was prescient enough to leave Germany before most when he still could.
We had to.
But often it's asked, why didn't more people leave?
That's something I have never understood. I've always felt, and I was a very young child, but later on, as I looked into it, I have always felt that the Jewish community, if Hitler had not been anti-Semitic, many of them, not all of them, but many of them would have had sympathy with that movement.
In fact, initially, he did get some money from some rich Jews who thought that the anti-Semitism was just a bit of demagoguery, but they liked the politics.
And that'll go away. And, of course, that was one of the pillars of his policies.
So your father was wanted as a spy, and you had to run again, even though he didn't want to go. And you went to the Spanish border?
Well, there was no more gasoline for my car or his car, and the railroad stations were overcome with people. And I finally got a push cart, put my grandmother of 82 on it, and some baggage, and that's how we left Paris.
You were how old at the time?
16. Mm-hmm. And we went all through France, bombed, machine gunned, and ended up in Marseille. And through the International Rescue Committee, Mrs. Roosevelt begged her husband, FDR, to give out at least a few hundred visas on an emergency basis to endangered intellectuals and people like Picasso and others. And my family got 4 of those. But, of course, we didn't get our French exit visa because my father was on the list that the Germans wanted. And so we had to go over the mountains, the Pyrenees, and here was a woman of 82, my grandmother, with us. I ended up carrying her, and we could see the French border station and the Spanish border station. We went to a Spanish border station, And they asked us, where's your French exit visa? Which, of course, was none of their business. And we bribed our way out and finally got to Lisbon and eventually to through a Portuguese ship called the Niassa, which was built for a little bit over 200 passengers, and there were over 1,000. And for an inside cabin for the four of us, my mother, my father, my grandmother, and I, we were charged $1,940, $500 each, which must be the equivalent of $7,000 today.
Hmm. But it was a time of desperation, and
absolutely.
Walter Benjamin, one of the greatest German thinkers of his time, committed suicide when he thought he was going to make it across the border. So despite the awfulness of the ordeal, you did make it and wound up in New York unable to speak English. So how does someone who's 17 years old learn? It's not the same as if you arrive when you're eight or nine.
I spoke some English in Paris at the Lycée. We were taught some English, but of course not fluently. But you learn and you have to. And I took some menial jobs and then got into radio. And one day I was walking on Broadway in the 90s and I saw an appliance store where they had installed a television set in the window. And about 20 people watched wrestling. And I came back several hours later, and that same store, the television set was still on. They were watching a test pattern. And I thought that was something I should look into. And I joined the Dumas Television Network, Channel 5 here in New York.
Captain Video and other major shows.
That's right.
Dumont was one of those companies that manufactured televisions and also had its own small network. But it's amazing that Dumont has totally disappeared from people's memories.
The commission in 1948 after the war didn't know how to allocate frequencies, what channel to go to what city, and what to do with UHF, which was in the background. And instead of a few weeks, which they said it would take, it took 4 years. 1952, they gave out licenses. And, of course, ABC, CBS, and NBC had relationships with radio stations. And most of their affiliates got the VHF channels, and poor Dumont, all through the country, mostly got UHF allocations. And except there's one problem, between 1948 and 1952 or 53, 25 or 30 million television sets were made. None of them could receive UHF.
And even if you could, you had to know how to do that thing where you went to the UHF thing and then you wiggled the other knob. It was a weird time, although you were, but Dumont was Channel 5 here.
That's right.
My guest is Ralph Baruch, who with Lee Roderick has written Television Tightrope, How I Escaped Hitler, Survived CBS, and Fathered Viacom. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how long were you at Dumont, and what got you to CBS?
I felt that Dumont was not long for this world, and an opportunity presented itself to become a salesman at CBS, and I took that opportunity and started as a salesman.
And worked your way up. You became the head of CBS Worldwide Distribution.
And I don't know why, but in 1959, CBS wanted me to get into international, head up their international television operation, probably because I spoke some languages, but they were in a terrible mess. And that's when I got my first taste of Hollywood, which an atmosphere I never took very much to and I didn't very much like. And I remember the friend of mine.
Why?
The atmospheres, the people are different. Let me tell you the story and that'll illustrate what I'm talking about. Bennett Newman was head of taxes, eventually ended up as an auditor for movies and producers and writers to audit studios, and he came into the studio and he said, I must object to Catherine Deneuve's expenses. And the man at the studio said, why? Well, she comes to New York and the limousines and the meals and everything else. She brings in drapes to be cleaned. And then she goes 5 or 6 Concorde seats to Paris and the same thing coming back. And I object to this. He said, why do you object to this? And he said, because I object to this because Catherine Deneuve is not in this picture. And this was typical of the Hollywood community. They make their money whenever they can. You can't trust them. I had an experience with David Beagleman, who was Judy Garland's agent, and some people say he was more than that. And we made a deal.
Later went to jail, didn't he, David?
He not only went to jail, he checked into a hotel and shot himself. But we made a deal. We shook hands on the deal. And then I found out that really wasn't a deal. And I called him. I said, remember we made this deal? Oh, yes. He said, I remember very well. I said, we shook hands? Yes. I said, what happened? Oh, he says, Ralph, I lie a lot. Well, how can you deal with people like that?
Your wife had an amusing encounter with Ava Gabor.
Yes, every year for our Canadian friends, we gave a party when they came down to Hollywood, to Los Angeles, to look at the new product, which was going on the air that fall. And we paid for the whole party, and this was at Eva Gabor's house. And I was newly remarried then. I'd become a widower. And my wife had a very attractive dress on, which was very low cut and had sort of a rose at the end of the low cut. And all the Canadians want to smell that rose. But Eva Gabor, who looks like a fire plug, came up to her, looked her up and down, and said, darling, I want your dress. And Jean said, well, I'll tell you where I had it made. No, 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 I want your dress. And Jean said, well, you can't have it. And, you know, it won't fit you. Oh, I have people, she said, who can alter these dresses. I want your dress. And Jean says, well, you can't have it. And Eva Gabor turned around, didn't say another word to her all through the evening.
Well, she wanted that dress. That's all I can tell you.
Yes.
This is around the time you also met Rupert Murdoch?
Well, I met Rupert Murdoch in Australia. And
when you were still with CBS?
Oh, yes. Well, he wanted something which he couldn't have, and he eventually sued us and lost. But
well,
that was in the early days. And
now he gets what he wants.
Oh, yes. And strangely enough, in his newest acquisition of the Wall Street Journal, you know, the FCC says a rule that you cannot own a newspaper and a radio station in the same market. He got a waiver for the New York Post because the New York Post lost a lot of money. But now he's buying a national newspaper. And how can the FCC justify him owning a paper which has circulation in every market and competes with television stations in the same market? I don't understand it, but I'm sure his acquisition will go through.
Was he anybody would have known when you met him? Did you have any sense that this is a guy?
He was very little known in those days. He had a television station, Stars television station in Wollongong, which is a suburb of Sydney. That's how I met him. And we continued our friendship. And I remember watching election returns at his home when he had an apartment on Fifth Avenue. And I was sitting there with an editor of the Daily News, and we were watching the set when somebody planted himself right in front of the set. And I tapped this gentleman on the shoulder and said, would you mind moving just a little bit so we can watch? And he turned around and said, yes, I would mind. That was Roy Cohn.
Well, he was consistent, wasn't he?
Yes.
I understand that executives at CBS would ask your opinion about a show, and if you liked it, then they would immediately assume it was going to fail.
I never got involved in the creative side. If I liked the script, they would say, oh, God, that's going to be a failure. And if I hated it, they'd say, oh, we have a chance here.
Were you wrong? Or, I mean, were you ever right? Did you like things that did well despite what?
Very rarely.
And what do you think is the reason for that? Are you just bad at TV, or are you taste a little too refined?
I don't have the creative judgment when reading a script as to what's good and what's bad.
So it's interesting that people who get into this business usually have a real sense of what the public sensibilities are.
I think there are two types in this business. There are the business people and the creative people. And I never try to mix one with the other.
So what happens when you watch television, or you've watched it over the years? Have you always disliked what was going on the channels that you were connected with?
At home, we when we had children, we watched certain series. But when they were grown, we now watch mostly Channel 13. And I happen to love that channel because also I'm on the board of trustees of Channel 13. And we enjoy what they offer in Channel 21 and others.
But many people who are in the commercial side of the business hate public broadcasting. They see it as if the numbers were bigger, and in the case of WNYC, we have great numbers. But if public broadcasting numbers were better around the country, I suspect there would be a hue and cry from all of the people in commercial broadcasting about cracking down.
Yes, but on the other hand, look at it in New York, for example. Channel 13 used to be a commercial channel. And Frank Stanton, maybe not for purely bona fide reasons, but he thought that Channel 13 ought to belong to the educational system. And he provided money, advice, and the equipment. And it also took a competitor out of the market.
Although it was the most highfalutin competitor out there. They were already broadcasting, I remember, productions of Broadway plays like The Iceman Cometh. And this is a commercial station. Jacques Venza was, I think, doing those things when it was still commercial. So it was not like Channel, CBS, ABC, or NBC. And I actually missed that station. I thought
really?
It was pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But something happened over the years. Why has there been so much of an FCC dissatisfaction with the way American broadcasting has run?
Well, John Galbraith used to say that regulators either fall into the pockets of the industries they're supposed to regulate or they become senile. I think the FCC has never done anything right for our communication system. They gave us a bad signal, 525 lines on television. Europe has 625
the,
lines.
The NTSC approach.
That's correct.
Which people in the business used to call never the same color, but when it went into color. But they said it was because the European system had more lines, it would flicker and it would tire people's eyes.
Of higher quality. They gave us a color system, the CBS color system, which of course didn't work, was non-compatible. So if you had a black and white set, you couldn't watch color. And if you had a color set, you couldn't watch black and white. But they approved that for 3 years or 4 years, and then they finally approved the RCA system.
Are they doing better with HDTV?
Well, in 2009, and this is not generally known, it is estimated that 75 million television sets who do not have cable or satellites will not be able to receive television signals unless they buy a converter box. And the government will issue applications, which you can get two to a home, and you fill those out, and the government will send you $40 per box, two to a home, so you can receive television signals, because it'll go from analog to digital in 2009. That's not so far away, and this is a well-kept secret.
My guest is Ralph Baruch, who was with CBS until the FCC cracked down and Viacom was spun off. And he tells the story of his career in television tightrope, How I Escaped Hitler, Survived CBS, and Fathered Viacom, in a book that is published by Probitas Press. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Ralph Baruch, who has written, with the help of Lee Roderick, Television Tightrope, How I Escaped Hitler, Survived CBS, and Fathered Viacom, published by Probitas Press. So there you are in the at CBS, and the FCC starts cracking down on the networks in the 70s because they felt that the networks had an oligopoly?
Well, the networks dominated the television business, and the FCC actually was in the late 60s, took a look at them. And if you were a producer and you wanted to get a show on the air, there were only ABC, CBS, or NBC as possible outlets. And if you offered that show to them, they say, yeah, we like your show, but if we put it on, we want all rights. We want merchandising, licensing, syndication, every right. And you say, well, I don't want to give up these rights. Well, then you have to go elsewhere. So it's an oligopoly.
So the FCC had good reason to go after the networks at that
point. I believe so, yes.
Even though you were probably defending the networks.
Absolutely. That's
against
my
the FCC.
Job. And in 68, Frank Stanton, who was then the president of CBS, I headed up that division in syndication and cable, and asked me to submit a plan as to what CBS should do. And I submitted a plan. They modified it quite a bit. But in 1970, decided that they're going to spin off that little company that does syndication, something else, into a new company. And for every seven shares of CBS, you'd get one share of this new company, which was then unnamed. And CBS, in my opinion, tried to do everything to kill off that little company. There were about 210 people, very little in sales, but the first head of it to be, he never became the head, his nickname was Chief Crazy Horse at CBS.
Clark George.
Clark George, head of radio. We had a general counsel that they wanted to get rid of who was an alcoholic. The head of cable was to be a man who was associate general counsel of CBS, who didn't get the top job when it became available, and was very bitter, so push him off to Viacom. And Frank Stanton named the company Viacom, which I thought was not a very good name, and he liked it, and so it was Viacom. We called it Viacom then. So we started out, and within a year we were sued by the government, antitrust, along with ABC, NBC, CBS, and Viacom. And we said, why Viacom? And they said, well, you're part of CBS. And we said, wait a minute, another part of the government, the FCC, decided three times we weren't separate enough, and now we are separate from CBS. And it cost us over $1 million in legal fees, and we had an indemnification agreement with CBS, and I presented the bill to CBS, the general counsel, and he said, I'm not going to pay it. And I said, what do you mean you're not going to pay? He said, sue us. And that's how they treated us. But nevertheless, we started out in television and bought television stations, radio stations, and we were fairly successful.
So this, to some degree, is like what happened when NBC gave up the Blue Network and ABC was created, except that Viacom never became as big.
That's right. And
but how were you totally independent of CBS?
Oh, absolutely. Completely and absolutely separate. And
when you were made the head in 71. So
I was made the head.
After Clark George
resigned.
Why was he called Chief Crazy Horse? How crazy was he?
He had his salesman. He had fingernail inspection at CBS. And
he looked at the fingernails?
Yes, every morning. All the salesmen had to present.
I think he was my third grade teacher.
In the third, in the period that he came, to Viacom, I made an office available to him, and every morning I found 8 or 10 slips under my door. His door was always closed. My wife went to see his wife, who had surgery on her back in a hospital nearby, and my wife came to pick me up one day to go out to dinner on business, and he saw her and came out of his office, gave her a buck slip, and went back to his office, and the buck slip said to Jean Baruch from Clark George, thank you for being so kind to Junie when she was in the hospital. And this was his modus operandi.
So they got rid of him and they put you in charge. But this was still a small potatoes operation, wasn't it?
Yes. But for example, he wanted to put an ad in the top 100 newspapers in the country, one page ad when we were officially spun off. And I tried to outline to him that would eat up our profits for the year. And he couldn't understand that. He wanted to make this another CBS. But we came along, and then we went into consultation on our long-range plans, and we decided that cable offered an opportunity for pay television. But the FCC restricted the kind of movies, for example, that you could show on cable. And again, I was asked to head up the committee, and together with many others, including Jerry Levin of HBO, we eventually ended up suing the FCC. But since I had a terrible relationship with the chairman of the FCC, Dick Wiley, I asked Jerry Levin, I said, Jerry, you know, if this is Viacom versus FCC, that will not be very well received. And he said, well, we'll call it HBO versus FCC. And so we did, and we won the case. And that really liberated the pay cable business.
There was the 1984 Cable Act that also changed.
I beg your pardon?
The 1984 Cable Act that changed the television landscape.
Well, it's in 1977, the industry asked me to head up a committee to help the Commerce Committee of the House and the Senate to revise the Communications Act, which had not been revised since 1934. And it took 7 years, and in 1984, that was adopted by about 10 minutes before adjournment of the Congress. The rates for cable were liberated, but I try to tell the cable industry, don't get greedy, because if you get greedy, you're going to see regulation again. Well, unfortunately, my advice was not followed. They got greedy, and they were, a few years later, regulated again.
My guest is Ralph Baruch, who's written Television Tightrope, How I Escaped Hitler, Survived CBS, and Fathered Viacom, published by Probitus Press. One of the great ironies is that in 1999, Viacom bought CBS, and nobody at the FCC said, hey, there's a problem.
No, absolutely.
The world has changed that much. But the way you describe this whole thing, it really sounds like a cutthroat business. People who you helped, a man named Terry Elkes, is it Elkes?
Elkes.
Elkes, a protege of yours, he winds up stabbing you in the back. There's an awful lot of that stuff going on.
Yes, I must admit that. It's a rough business, and you have to be on your guard at all times. But in 1985, we had heard that Warner Communications and its chief, Steve Ross, had run into financial problems because of their losses with Atari. And so we approached them, and we decided that we may want to buy MTV, which they plan to go public with, at least 20% of it. And we ended up buying MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, the movie channel, and the half of Showtime, which we had sold them previously, for less than $600 million. Today, that's worth several tens of billions of dollars, of course. But that was an interesting episode because we owned all of Showtime at one time. And then we asked Teleprompter, which was the largest cable system in the country at that time, to convert their HBO subscribers to Showtime, and we'd sell them half of Showtime for $3 million. And they did, and then Westinghouse bought Teleprompter, and the head of Westinghouse Broadcasting came in and shared our management committees and said, too many R movies, Ralph. And I said, well, this is what the audience wants.
They're paying for a different kind of a movie.
That's right. And I said, but if you don't want R movies, we'll buy it buy back half of Showtime that you own. And no, we're not selling. Well, I did a lot of work for President Reagan on a pro bono basis, and he organized a luncheon one time, and I managed to sit next to the CEO of Westinghouse. And I said, we have something in common. He said, what's that? I said, Showtime. Oh, he said, that little thing. I said, well, what's a little thing for you? It's a very big thing for us. But he was well briefed, and he said, too many R movies. And I said, well, the same thing. That's what the audience wants, et cetera. And then I lied my head off, and I said, I'm thinking of putting on X-rated movies at midnight. And his face went white. I went back to New York, and a day later, I got a call from the head of Westinghouse Broadcasting to have lunch. They're willing to sell. And so we bought it back for $60 million.
Now, how did Sumner Redstone get into this story?
Well, Terry Elkes, who was whom I hired as general counsel, as you said, was my protege, and moved him, despite some of my board members' objections, moved him into various higher executive positions, eventually I thought should be heading up the company. And I convinced the board he should be CEO, and I would stay on as chairman. And then one day he came to me, and his whole attitude changed as soon as he became CEO. But he came to me and said, Ralph, we're going to do a leverage buyout. And I said, oh, that's good, because we know what to sell and what to do with a company. Oh, you say we all the time. You're not part of that group. I formed an inside group, and you're not part of it. You've got to realize you have no more power base, and you're dead meat. Well, he tried to do it very cheaply, and Sumner Redstone's attention was drawn to this deal, that somebody was trying to buy the company very cheap. He outbid Terry Elkes three times and bought the company for the equivalent. We had split twice for $222 a share, $55.50 a share, while our stock, when Irving Kahn, one of the Teleprompter owners, went to jail in the 70s, our stock hit a low of 2 5/8. So we got 100 times that price, so we did very well for our shareholders.
Although Terry Elkes was kind of hoisted by his own petard in this
yes.
case. Now, Sumner Redstone has become a major character. Did you have to work with him?
No. He asked me to work for him. Coming back from a company picnic one day, and I was trying to concentrate on my driving while he's telling me what he wants me to do. But I didn't think that after having been CEO, I want to work for anybody else again.
Well, he may not be the best person to work for, especially if you're one of his kids.
Well, that's a personal thing of his. He has been very good to me, and I have no complaint.
But as I said earlier, this does seem like a nest of vipers, this whole business. People who are your protégés suddenly are making up deals behind your back. And there are a number of other nasty things that happen throughout this book. What do you think it is? Is it because the money is so big, or is it because people suddenly find themselves in a position where they're broadcasters and they see that they can really reach America, and now they have delusions of grandeur?
And they have tens of thousands of people working for them. It's a combination of both. I think it's power and greed. I think greed is...
I want both. I want money and I want power, but I don't know if I'm ready to stab anybody in the back.
That's right. Well, you have your own ethics, as I hope I do. But a lot of people in this industry don't always stick to that line.
What do you? How do you interpret the decline of the three major networks? Do you see that as something that's turned out to be good or not so good?
Well, it's competitive. I'm not sure it's good. Fred Silverman, who was head of NBC at one time and whom I knew at CBS, said something once: television appeals to the lowest, the lowest common denominator. Television has sunk in terms of what I call quality a great deal, but Channel 13, PBS, and other channels are doing the very thing that the networks used to do. But eventually, I think television will come over the internet entirely.
And that'll just eliminate everything. But
yes.
They're still going to have to sell advertising.
And, oh, yes, absolutely.
And that's been the big difference. In the old days when they were the oligopolies, they were pretty much the only source of viewers. Now it's spread out over so many different channels on cable. Nobody can really deliver that many viewers.
That's right. And it's split, and the audience is compartmentalized much more and according to demographics, which is also somewhat unfortunate.
And now the fourth network, which isn't really a network but something like a network, Fox, it often beats the old majors.
That's right. They are very creative, and they come up with some formats which audiences like, obviously. There it is, and I think eventually everything will come over the internet and the computer.
So except for being a trustee at Channel 13 these days, are you totally out of the business?
Yes. I feel that I have to pay back my country, this country, which has been very, very good to me. I spent 24 years on the board of Carnegie Hall. I was a vice chairman. I chaired their centennial and became very close to Isaac Stern, my good friend.
Because you felt it was your responsibility, or because you felt that you should be supporting classical music?
I felt I should do some good and not only make money, but help people raise money for other good causes. I'm the trustee of Lenox Hill Hospital. And I feel this is something I helped. A friend of mine start a foundation. His daughter died of leukemia, and I helped him start a foundation. This is the kind of thing one should do.
When you turn on the television, other than Channel 13, what are you likely to watch?
I watch the Discovery Channel. I watch these kind of programs and movies mostly.
So mostly cable.
I beg your pardon?
Mostly cable.
Yes.
I guess since you helped create that... that beast, the least you could do is pay some lip service to it. Larry King says this. Larry King should be totally grateful to you, so he gave you a blurb here. Because CNN is something we didn't discuss, but there would be no CNN without cable.
And thanks to the vision of a man Ted Turner, who has great vision. He's a little bit crazy, but he has this vision. And he has started CNN, all coming out of a little UHF station in Atlanta, which he put on the satellite, TBS. And he had this vision and eventually bought the MGM library and started the Turner Classic Movies and other channels.
Now, there was a time when I thought AMC was the best place to see movies. That was yours. But Ted Turner is much better, don't you think? And he's not showing, he's not doing commercials, he's not editing the films.
That's right. And he shows some marvelous movies of the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, when motion pictures really were superb. Some of them are absolutely superb, some are not, but you have to be selective.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Ralph Baruch, who really did play a major role in changing the way we watch television, all those channels and nothing to watch. His memoir is called Television Tightrope, How I Escaped Hitler, Survived CBS, and Fathered Viacom. It is published by Probitas Press. And I have to tell you, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
My pleasure.
This is WNYC. On tomorrow's show, horticulturist Gerard Lordahl takes your calls on nurturing your plants throughout the summer heat, and then Lucette Lagnado on fleeing the cosmopolitan glamour of Cairo after Nasser came to power, plus the Civil War veterans buried in Brooklyn's Greenwood Cemetery, and on Please Explain, all about oceans, currents, rivers, and lakes. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Sophie Rand, Gabrielle Galanek, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Jay Cout was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.